Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, the word is out. They're gonna talk about the VOD and the silver screen. Kevin and Tom and Joe know all there is to know, from masterpieces to deep fried tacos. And if the movie sucks, you might hear them say, there's no telling where the guys will take you. Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice, cause we already warned you. Better watch out, it's gonna ruin the plot.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 631, Raya and A Last Dragon.
The streak continues. There's a Last Dragon in it, so.
Well, spoilers, no there's not.
Well, it depends on when you watch the movie, you see. I mean, they could get you on the technicality.
Yeah. So let's go around the virtual table and we can introduce ourselves.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. There is no Joe this week, so we'll let that you decide if that's a good or a bad thing, but he's not here. And joining us from Strange Harbors, it's Jeff Zhang. Hi. Hey, Jeff. How's it going? I stumbled because I was like, wait, was it Jeff or Jeffrey?
No, it's okay. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be joining you guys to talk about this movie. So my name is Jeff Zhang. I'm editor-in-chief and of the film and pop culture blog Strange Harbors. I am a film critic and writer and the host of my own podcast, the Strange Harbors podcast. It's great to be here to talk to you guys about this movie.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for getting. Where are you at? Where are you located at?
I'm in New York.
Okay, so we didn't get you up at like 6 o'clock in the morning to do this.
I'm up at six like in the morning anyway. I've got a 1 year old, so
that'll do it.
I left my wife with a kid this morning just to come in and do the podcast. So it's nice to get a little reprieve in the morning.
Absolutely. Here's the worst thing. So I'm at the other end of it, right? I have a 21 and a soon to be 17 year old, and so now I can sleep in, but it's like I just wake up at at like 5:30 on a Sunday for no reason, and it sucks. I remember watching like my parents and grandparents do that and thinking, what is wrong with them? And it's like, you don't have a choice. It just happens. That's what you have to look forward to. That and a lot of peeing on your part.
I was going to say from the baby, because I'm dealing with that now too, but then, okay.
Yes, no, it will switch. <It'll>
And then soon they'll be changing your diapers and
a reversal of fortune. Before we dig into the movie, shameless plugs. Don't forget we're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts. Wherever you find podcasts, you can find us. While you're there, be sure and subscribe so you never miss an episode. And, of course, leave a review if you would be so kind, so the people coming along after you know that maybe we're worth a shot. And then you can also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/realspoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group. And one of the easiest things you can do to support the show is just share an episode with friends or loved ones, like through your social media, and don't just go around telling them. I mean, you can, but it's not as effective. So people who were kind enough to share an episode this week: Chris Williams, Librarian Cynthia, Lane Levanway, Travis Tewitt, Ralph Tribble, Tammy Sherman Powers, Chris Falls, Heather Sachs, Gabriel Lugo, Julianne Jordan, Aaron Marlowe, Ron Johnson, Glenn Cougar, Mellon Brewer, Chris Magic Man, Chris Sanders, Brad Hyen, Cinema Recall, Mike and Oscar, Colby Mack, Emmett Miller Film Reviews, The We Have a Hulk Podcast, Josh Dykstra, Invasion of the Remake, The Movie Journey, It's a Fandom Thing, Geek to Me Radio, Die Christine, Matt Neglia, Ronnie Castle, Binge Films, Feel and Film, In Session Film, and Ryan Terry from the Forza Crowd Podcast. So thank you very much, everybody, for sharing. We greatly appreciate it. And finally, one last way you can help out, our Patreon, patreon.com/realspoilers, where for $5 a month, you get all sorts of bonus content, and you help us out, like when a computer shits the bed, which happens. So thank you for everyone who does all of that. There's everything. I guess let's dig in to Raya and the Last Dragon. See, I do actually know the title.
We never doubted you. Well, oh, I'll take that back.
Yeah, there are times I don't know the title. Let's not kid ourselves. I should explain to Jeff. I get, like, sometimes movies have thes for no reason, or they don't have thes when they should have thes, and it causes me unending consternation, and I always fail at it.
Sometimes it just drifts into movies without thes, or sometimes right. with it's two like, thes. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. My favorite band, The.
So, Raya and the Last Dragon. I didn't look too much up into this film as it was going through development and everything. And really, it just when it hit like a year ago when they were showing images and trailers and things, I that was the first time I really learned about the film. And it looked really cool. And of course, I stayed away from the trailers as I usually do. And just but Disney is always getting better with the animation, and you know they keep looking better and better. So all these images were stunning, and I really enjoyed this film overall. I didn't know what to expect, but I knew it would look breathtaking, and I thought it was a really cool adventure movie. I loved all the Eastern culture, the animation, the voice acting was excellent. So I just going into it didn't really know what to expect, and I think this is, you know, pretty much top tier Disney, you know, of their CG stuff since they came back from with Tangled and Zootopia, Big Hero 6 and all that. So I had a lot of fun with this one. I know Tom, I'm curious what Tom's thoughts are, because we only had a brief conversation before this, but where did you land on this one?
I thought this thing was a snooze. Oh. It's a beautiful film. And yeah, the voice acting is great, but from a story standpoint, it's a beautiful film. I really got put off by this theme of trust in the film, because the movie opens with someone trusting somebody and literally destroying the world that they know. Everything about the world is completely effed because this guy trusted somebody he shouldn't have. And then I never really saw any reason that we should choose to trust people again other than, wouldn't that be a cute message? And so, like, I just found myself getting really frustrated with the story of this film, because I'm just like, why would any of these people trust each other after what had just occurred? I didn't really feel like we ever had that moment that, like, that caused some sort of epiphany within a character or characters that would justify, like, let's trust again.
Okay. Well, yeah, let's get into that as we get through the story, because I do think that's interesting. The film is clearly based on that and what they learn along the way and eventually beginning to trust each other. Jeff, what was your background with the film, and where did you end up landing on it?
I think, Kevin, my experience is probably the same as yours. I didn't pay too much attention to it just because of, like, the pandemic and, like, you know, like, it's like big Disney blockbuster type film, and you can't really see it in theaters. I'm just not so up to date with, like, the big studio movies like these days, but closer to the release date, I started paying more attention because, you know, it had a lot of Southeast Asian representation, which I really liked. But I think this is good because we have a good representation across the spectrum of how we receive the movie. You guys are at two opposite ends. I think I'm kind of in the middle. I do agree this is a gorgeous, gorgeous movie. It's beautiful. I think Disney just pulls out all the stops with each new release that they do with their animation studio. I think this one's like Frozen 2 was only like what, a year and a half ago, and this already looks like heads and shoulders above it in terms of like animation, and like I think like the physics animation has gotten to the point where like you can actually do like a a real martial arts type epic, right? Like, I think the fight scenes and everything in this are great.
That's what's cool is we've never really seen that in Disney animation.
Yeah, we've never seen that.
So I thought that was really cool. And speaking to Frozen 2 real quick, I remember when that trailer, like the teaser trailer came up and you saw the water physics and everything and how photorealistic mm-hmm. that one looked. And I agree, like at that point, it was on a whole different level where they had stepped up their animation so far. And this continues on that, especially when you look at the water. I mean, since Moana with the water, I think really Moana, Frozen 2, and then this, they've really nailed that look of it and the lighting and reflection and everything. So yeah, breathtaking visuals.
Right. Yeah. But I also agree with Tom that I think the through line of trust is a little ham-fisted in this. I think they kind of beat you over the head with it. And doesn't really quite earn like the big moment in the end. I don't think it does. But you know, it's in the end, it's a kid's movie, and I think there's a little bit of dissonance with like all the fighting and the combat in this movie, and how ultimately toothless it is a little bit, just because you know it's for children.
Yeah. Toothless dragons. Nice.
The wrong dragon movie.
I didn't even make the wrong dragon movie. Right.
But you know. When you say, you know, oh, it's just a kid's movie, okay, but, like, don't you think maybe teaching kids to have trust in people for no reason isn't maybe the best message to send a kid, right? Like, I mean, there are a lot of people that will victimize children, and I don't mean to be like, this movie's encouraging kids, but I mean,
right.
It's like, on the one hand, you go, well, it's a kid's movie, and but on the flip side, like, well, maybe that's more of a reason to be upset. Oh, and upset's a strong word.
That message would be better if it was earned.
Right, totally. Like, I don't feel like this movie, and I guess we'll get to it as we dig into the plot points, but I agree that I don't think the movie ever really earns the pivot that it makes in Return to Trust, when literally the first two-thirds of the movie is her dealing with the ramifications of her dad trusting everybody for no reason, and then the solution is for her to just trust those exact same people one more time. Like that, I don't know. Like,
well, I mean, and yeah, we can get into it more as we go, but to me, it was more of the overarching, like the idea of trust. It's not just blind trust, and it's not like, well, you, one person should just trust whoever, but I think it was more of a message for a better world that everyone should learn to trust and work together. And so at face value, I can totally see like in today where you have to be careful and there's a lot of creepers out there and, you know, you have to teach your kids to be careful and not just blindly trust. But I think the film is telling us that if everybody would work together and trust more, as all these factions had to do, all different people, young, old, no matter who they are, you know, if the world would be a better place. So I don't think it was just like, hey, you kid, learn this lesson. It was more like, wow, wouldn't this be a lesson for a better world?
I guess the difference is that like most messages in kids' movies, you can do unilaterally and have them be successful to some degree, right? Like follow your dreams, mm-hmm. right? We see that one all the time. And, like, you can follow your dreams even if someone else isn't following their dreams, right? But if you trust someone mm-hmm. and they're not trustworthy, you trusting them doesn't make them trustworthy, right?
Just like just we see.
It's the beginning
of the movie, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, it's not, trust isn't something that you can just, you know, do unilaterally. If you trust someone who isn't trustworthy, you're going to get burned. And so, and we see it happen in the movie. Mm-hmm. And so like that was one of the big problems I had with the movie, and is just that I'm like, this is a weird thing to build the film around. And I thought that like there'd be some moment where we'd see like some sort of like true movement towards how they rebuilt trust. And it was really just somebody's just kind of like, well, I guess I won't screw him now. And why don't you believe me? And I'm like, well, because look what you did. Like, you haven't, you got to re-earn that. And I don't really feel like that character did. But
well,
let's dig into them.
Yeah, as we get through it, maybe we can look at the film and the moral more is, you know, you can get more done if you work together rather than apart. Because while trust is a theme of the film and you have to trust each other, especially when we get to that big moment, it's still all the factions just being what they are, factions and working in, you know, independently of one another. So rather than just use the word trust, we can say work together, which is a really a basic principle of a lot of kids things. And so it's more like, sure, instead of doing it on your own and being the best and wanting prosperity for your land, let's all work together and share things, and, you know, and then we can trade our crops from our different lands, and you know, everything's better together. So but yeah, so this story is about a mystical land called Kumandra, and it's this ancient ancient civilization, and of course this movie is heavy with the Eastern culture, and so dragons exist, and there's this, it's just, you see this beautiful landscape. The land of Kumandra is actually the river flows into what looks like a dragon. And so when this evil spirit, the Droon, comes through, it splits the people apart, and it splits the land into five different factions. So you have the Fang. You have Fang, which is like the main big bad guys of the movie. You have Heart, which is the good guys where Raya is from. You have Spine. You have Tail. And you have Talon. Is that right?
Wasn't there like Spleen, yeah, and Butthole?
No, they no. Unfortunately, they turned to stone, and there wasn't enough X-lax. It was a whole thing. They just had to stay cemented up. But
that makes sense. Who would trust a butthole,
right? Like
that's a bridge too far for this screenplay.
So not a lot of fart jokes in this movie. You know, some kids' movies, they lean on the fart jokes, and this one doesn't have to go there. I like that. We don't need the fart jokes. What there are dragons, like I mentioned earlier at this time, and the dragons end up, this is like 500 years before the story really takes off when we see little Raya, but telling the story of how everything came to be, there were dragons everywhere. They all have different powers that we come to find out from different parts of the movie that we're going to see. And they use all of their last remaining power to fight off the Droon, who is everything that it touches, it turns the people to stone. And so they use their powers. They're able to get the people to turn back into their human form. But in doing so, they're drained of their powers, and they end up turning to stone. But they put their power, the last of their powers, into an orb. And so the different dragons have, and of course we learn this all throughout the movie, but for people that may just be listening, their individual powers are in this orb, and so it contains them all, and it is what keeps the Droon at bay for hundreds and hundreds of years. So this orb ends up, it's guarded and protected by the people of Heart. So that would be Raya, and that would be her father, who is played by Daniel Day-Kim. And this movie does have a great cast of actors. Daniel Day-Kim, always great as always. He plays Chief Benja, and again, Raya's father. And he's teaching her about, you know, the responsibility of protecting this orb. And, you know, we see our first really good martial arts sequence where you don't know what Raya is doing, but she's sneaking into this cave where you see this, you know, mythical orb floating there, and she faces off against who we find out is her father, and we see how skilled she is from a young age. She's been training all this time. And so her father ends up having all the people who are now at this point, they're all very split off into these five factions, and he wants to bring them together because he realizes that, of course, things together will, you know, they can work together, and it'll be much better than everyone fending for themselves. But these other lands, the other four areas, blame Heart, for hoarding the orb as opposed to just protecting it. They feel like the orb is bringing them prosperity, and they have very nice looking lands and plentiful food. And so when they are invited to this dinner, Fang ends up orchestrating an attack, and we're introduced to Gemma Chan's character, Namari, who is around the same age as Raya, and she is huge.
I always love when kids' movies like trust the fate of political machinations to like 8-year-olds.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're around the same age, and she's really into dragons. So she ends up infiltrating, gaining Raya's trust, because Raya loves dragons, and Namari has a necklace, and she has stolen the map about, you know, where you can find the last dragon, the titular last dragon, Sisu, who is supposed to be the one that did not.
Well, I know it's a female dragon, but I don't know if we should say that.
What did I say?
Titular.
Oh. God. It's a kid's movie, Tom, for God's sakes.
You're the one that said titular.
So Namari ends up gaining her trust. And of course, the naive Raya, who just wants a friend and isn't used to having that, says, oh, well, guess what? If you like dragons, boy, do I have something to show you. And she ends up taking her right into the secret guarded lair of the orb. And of course, Namari's like, oh, that's so great. And then ends up kicking her to the ground and, you know, reveals that she's really just been playing her all along. And thanks for leading me right to it. And that she's going to steal the orb. And now Fang will have it and be prosperous and be in charge and all that stuff. So she ends up sending up this firework to tell her mom and the other warriors from Fang. It ends up all the factions converge onto the cave, and they see it, and they all fight over it and struggle for themselves to get it for themselves. They end up breaking the orb into pieces, and each of the leaders of the factions steals a piece of the orb. So we see that the Droon comes back. It starts turning everybody to stone that it touches, and only the people with that orb are able to fend it off. In the process, where everyone's getting attacked and turned to stone, Raya's father, during their scuffle, which, again, the martial arts stuff is really cool that we touched upon. Not only do we see Raya and her father with their training session, or, you know, their sparring session, but we see her father fend off all these different people that are attacking him to try to get to the orb. And we should mention, his sword is awesome. This is such a cool thing, and why I really loved this movie, aside from the martial arts, is how creative they get with the weapons and the fighting and everything. And it's never violent. I mean, you know, sure, this may be like on the 8-9-year-old Disney movie. You know, it's not for maybe little kids, but they never get real violent. And I'm sure that kids around that age are watching things like, whether it's Avatar The Last Airbender or, you know, other anime. I mean, kids,
well, the martial arts aspect allows it to not be bloody. Like, you're not true. Questioning why they're not bleeding.
True, you know, especially with the hand-to-hand stuff. But like,
right,
even with the sword, it's not like Raya's dad is, you know, piercing people with swords, and, you know, it's never violent like that. But anyway, it's really cool to see the martial arts in animation like this, because we haven't gotten a chance to see fight choreography to this extent in a Disney animated feature, and you don't see it in many CG animated films. But it was really cool to see it at the forefront of this Disney movie. And her dad has this sword that compartmentalizes. It actually breaks apart. It's this huge sword, and breaks apart into a chain like whip kind of a weapon. And so he's able to grab things with it. And it's a really, and we find out you can, you know, like, use it as a, like, what would you call it? Like a, like, you can shoot it into the ceiling, and you can,
a grappling hook?
Yeah, almost like a Batman grappling hook type thing. So it's a really versatile, really cool weapon that you get to see. And through this amazing animation, it's so detailed how it comes together. But anyway, he's injured in that fight. He's shot with an arrow that he deflects, because he's that badass. He deflects this arrow with his sword or something, or in his hand real quick, but it ends up going into his leg. So he can't get away from the Droon fast enough when they're all running. He turns to stone, and he pushes Raya off this bridge so that she'll go down into the water and be able to escape from it. And then that's pretty much how that whole thing went down. We've got the five factions. They're all split up. They've all got a piece of the orb. And then we fast forward 6 years, and that's where we see Raya, the one from the poster and the trailers and everything. And so really the land has turned into a post-apocalyptic wasteland where
I think this story could have worked better if the dad hadn't turned to stone and it had been more of like The Road. Remember the book,
like
The
them
Road,
two together
the
having to
yeah those yeah. two together traversing this world as this dad grapple, like, now he's been burned. And let him be the one that's like, don't trust anybody. And her be like, well, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, I just, plus it would have kept him in the movie longer. But
that's a good idea, actually. I think I like Daniel could take him too.
He's great.
He would have benefited from a little more screen time. And I don't know. I think the fetch questy aspect of this movie kind of gets in the way. Like, if you just, you know, like, they're just traveling from land to land trying to get the pieces of the stone. And like, it's kind of like rinse and repeat, right? I think it would have benefited if Raya had someone other than, you know, Sisu to play off of.
And I think it would have allowed Sisu to be, like, more mischievous, because, like, in a lot of ways, she almost ends up being sometimes the voice of reason, which is an odd position for, like, the comic relief of the film to take on. And so,
right,
I think it would it would allow Raya to play in between these two as like a mitigating force, and then Awkwafina could be, I don't know, funnier. I mean, not that she wasn't funny, but that like she could have, it could have been more so, instead of she would like her character wouldn't have been needed to advance the plot quite so much.
Right. You know what I mean? Her, I mean, really, you're right. Sisu is the voice of reason for a lot of it, and has to end up teaching Raya to trust and to believe in people, and you know, instead of attacking people, give them a gift and all that stuff. So you're right. If Sisu could have had a little bit more fun and then maybe played off of the dad as the straight man or something. But on the flip side, I think what this film really does is it's empowering, as we've gotten many films lately for women and young girls that are going to be watching the movie. Raya's a really cool character, right? So Raya's voiced by Kelly Marie Tran, who you might recognize as Rose Tico from the Star Wars The Last Jedi and a couple seconds of Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker. Still will never forgive J.J. Abrams for how dirty he did Rose Tico, but you know, we can discuss that another time and already have. But I think Kelly Marie Tran does a fantastic job. Like she's, we talk about sometimes how celebrities, and of course it's a lot of times when there's a bigger name celebrity, you know, they're lending their voice, but they're not really doing a voice. They're just kind of there. And a lot of kids' movies go that route instead of a trained voice actor. And so I don't know Kelly Marie Tran as far as her experience with voice acting. Like, I am not familiar with a lot of work. Like, this is the biggest thing I've ever seen her do that in. And I thought she was great. Like, she was 100% giving it her all. I could sense the emotion, you know, the weight of those emotional scenes. She was funny. She had that, like, you know, leading action charisma to her voice. So I thought she did a fantastic job in the lead of this film. And I'm really glad to see her being able to take on a big role like this. And I know it's animated, so you're not going to see her in, you know, in front of the camera, but I mean, it's still a huge role. This is a Disney movie. She's a Disney princess by, you know, canon now. And hopefully it will lead to more things, because it's really a shame what ended up happening with Star Wars. But anyway, that will be the last time I'll mention Star Wars. But
ever?
Well, at least in this movie. At least okay. For this movie.
I find it fascinating that I've noticed that with the Disney princesses, and I mean, it's not crazy, but they, I feel like the average age of the voice actor playing the Disney princess keeps getting younger and younger. Like, I think that they're thinking long term of like, oh, we want these people to be able to voice these characters for 30, 40 years across theme park rides and sequels and video games and appearances and other, just all these different media that they'll want to like have them pop up in. And so I feel like they're, you know, they don't want to cast, you know, a 40 or 50 year old person to play some of these characters. They want somebody who's in their 20s so they can use them forever, you know,
that makes sense.
For a long time, you know?
Yeah, definitely. But so Raya being the main character, and I think her going on this quest by herself, it's more empowering. I don't think the movie would have landed for what they were trying to do as much. Here you have a daughter again, and Moana did this really well too. So it's not like we're saying this is the first movie to ever do it, but we definitely have been seeing more of that. Frozen has taken that route. I mean, even from Tangled, you know, Entangled, Rapunzel. Tangled is the one that I think rebooted Disney. I mean, I don't know if we're all on the same page there, but like, where their Disney animation, Tangled was the point where Disney and Pixar, the line was blurred, and they started stepping up their quality. So
yeah,
they really started that. Mm-hmm, so with sure. Tangled, I mean, she doesn't have to get rescued, right? So you've got, you know, Flynn Rider, and he's a great character and everything, but he's more goofy, and Rapunzel's the badass, and so she can handle it herself. And we've seen this a lot, but now you've got the lead character, right? You don't have to have necessarily a whole cast, you know, co-leads, right? Like, Raya is the lead character. She's got the sidekick, and of course Sisu's a huge part of it, but really this is Raya's movie. It is right there in the title. And so she's the strong, capable woman that she knows martial arts. She's been in the desert for 6 years, you know, on her own. She of course does have her her creature, her, I don't know if you refer to him as a pill bug, something like that. He's like an armadillo and a bug combined, but he's gigantic. He's voiced by Alan Tudyk, because he
kind of wasted.
I mean, that's been his.
I didn't even know he voiced him until I didn't even know he had a voice. He just making like animal
That's
noises.
His thing, though. You know, Alan Tudyk now is their go-to. He voices like all the animals in all the Disney movies, which, I mean, you know, good for him. He's their go-to for sure. But she has this companion that, you know, was really cute and had some funny scenes when she was little. And then he grows up into this huge armadillo that she actually rides.
So they can sell you both versions of that stuffed right, animal.
The stuffed animal, and you've got the kid's ride-along toy. And, but Raya is front and center here, and while she does learn that it's good to have the help of others, you know, she's very capable and very strong. She doesn't need to get rescued. She just like anyone else can use help and needs to work together with people. But I think her going in this journey and discovering it for herself lends a lot more credence to the fact that, you know, she's more than capable to do that. I think if it were her father, it wouldn't have only been seen as like, well, of course, he's this older, more wise badass character. I think it would have been more like, well, you know, of course, a guy was helping her along the journey. And you know what I mean? I think it would have been perceived.
I get what you're saying. I guess I saw it more as like, if it had gone that direction, it's more of like the dad's the one who feels really burnt and isn't trusting anybody. Mm-hmm, and she's the one kind of pulling him back to like, no, everyone needs to work together. You know.
Yeah. No, I really like that idea. I just think it would have like defaulted to that. Like that would be part of the conversation that she couldn't find her journey on her own. And I think because we've had so many male leads and especially Disney, I mean, in all film and all animation, but especially in Disney animation, you know, they're trying to get away from that, to always having the male lead, like whether it be Simba or Aladdin, I mean, whatever. I mean, and of course you have the Little Mermaid, but you know, historically there's been a lot of these films where there's this male lead and they want the little girls growing up and watching the films not to just watch the princess that's good at singing and wants more. You know, they want the butt-kicking martial arts hero, and that's what we get with Raya, who is a really cool character. And so she goes on this journey, and basically like Jeff mentioned, really her goal is to reunite these five factions. And to do that, she needs to, well, first of all, she has to vanquish the Droon, which she needs the orb and the dragon magic to do. But she's going to have to get these pieces together. So the film is about her going to each of them. The first thing that she does is she goes to she steals the map that we saw earlier in the film when they were kids. She ended up, they don't show you how, but she stole it somehow from Fang. And it is the map of where Sisu, the last dragon, is supposed to be. So she ventures to this area where she uses this little necklace charm thing that Namari had given her as a child, and she does like a spiritual chant type of a thing. I don't know if you guys have any more information on how to better describe that, but she gives.
I do not.
She reads some kind of a incantation or whatnot, by doing that and putting some water on this thing, it materializes Sisu. And so Sisu is played by Awkwafina, as Tom mentioned earlier, and you know, it's a really goofy role. I like Awkwafina a lot. I could see how Awkwafina can easily get on someone's nerves. Like, you have to either like Awkwafina or you don't. I don't know if there's any middle ground with Awkwafina.
Yeah, I mean, I get what you're saying, but it also feel like we could say the same thing about Robin Williams. You know what
really?
I mean? Like, yeah, Robin Williams is irritating. Okay. Yeah, like when Robin Williams works, it's really funny. And when it doesn't work and he goes so fast, a lot of it doesn't work. I don't necessarily mean in Aladdin, but I just mean in general. A lot of what Robin Williams does, it's loud and it's fast, but it's not that funny. Like, if you read Robin Williams, I know this is a hot take because people love Robin Williams, but like, if you read what Robin Williams is saying a lot of times, like from his stand up or when he's on a talk show, it's not that funny.
Oh, it's not. It's not.
It's all attitude, right?
Right. It's not the words.
And like Robin Williams, a lot of times for me, more often, like he would irritate me as much as I would love him. Like, and so like I feel like that's absolutely true of Robin Williams.
That's
you know?
An apt comparison. I mean, the manic energy, I can see that for sure.
And I mean, really, this movie is kind of like, you know, not to be reductive, but I mean, it's kind of Mulan meets Aladdin. And I think one of the mistakes that they made with Awkwafina is not letting her be more Awkwafina, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like in Aladdin, they let Robin Williams come in and do what Robin Williams does.
True.
And then and then they honed that down and they picked it. It was really similar to like the first director that really figured out how to use Robin Williams was Barry Levinson in Good Morning Vietnam. And what he did was he knew he wasn't going to be able to stop Robin Williams. So he was like, you just do what you're going to do. And Robin Williams would do these 10-minute scenes as Adrian Cronauer, where he's on the radio going crazy. And then he'd be like, hey, guess what? 2 minutes of that was funny. So we're going to use that 2 minutes. Do these 2 minutes. And then he would do it again and again and hone it and tighten it. And then that's what you would see in the movie. And then, like, they kind of did that with Aladdin. They just pulled out the funny stuff and they animated to that. And they left a lot of that on the cutting room floor because it just wasn't that good. And I think that they should have let her come in and do what she does and be her and then pick out the best parts and build around that. And I really feel like for the most part, she was hewing pretty closely to the script and not really being herself. I mean, she would bring her personality with her line reading choices, you know, but I don't feel like she added content in the way that Robin Williams did. And that's a shame.
I could see that, because again, I really like Awkwafina. I mean, yeah. I do see now, looking at it from that way, that maybe she felt a bit restrained because she didn't get to be in her full Awkwafina mode, you know, and she did have a lot of heavy lifting to do as far as the lessons, and she had.
And in her defense, she's at a very different point in her career than Robin Williams was when he was in Aladdin.
Well, right? I think, like, that's the main reason why, is it's like, she, even though she's had some big movies, like she was in Jumanji 2 and then The Farewell, critically success, but she doesn't have the star power of Robin Williams at this point.
My issue is that she sounds like she's from Queens.
So. Yeah, she is kind of doing the Danny DeVito parody from Jumanji 2, right? It's almost like when she did that impression of him in that movie, it was kind of like the same voice.
But I mean,
I know she's caught some flack for it, you know, just because, like, it is kind of like the African American AAVE, you know, and people are saying she's like appropriating African American culture. But I don't know. I think that's just the way that she was brought up, and I don't think that was an issue back then when she was growing up. So I think that's just the quirk that she's grown up with.
I mean,
know?
That sneaks into her speech patterns a lot, though, right? Like, that's not a new thing.
It does.
Yeah, I think that's what he means. It's not for this movie. It's people in general maybe are making that complaint. But yeah, if you've watched Awkwafina over the years, I mean, that is her personality, and that's her. Yeah. So
Awkwafina's playing Awkwafina. Yeah. You know?
That's a difficult thing to unpack, because it's like, it's different when white people do it. Like, I don't know how else to say it. Like, when a white person talks like something that's not a part of their culture, it somehow it feels worse than when other cultures. Now it just feels more, I don't know, just the commingling of cultures in a way that it doesn't feel when a white person does it. Does that make sense? Am I offensive? I honestly don't know. But
I mean, I can see it, but there a lot of times.
Like, if I started talking like that right now, it's offensive, right?
Right.
I mean, it just is, right? In a way that, like, I think when somebody who isn't white, now it's more just like, well, where did she grow up and what culture is she from? And, like, she grew up in this neighborhood with lots of different cultures. It feels different.
Well,
sure.
You know?
Sure.
With her, she's from New York. So think about how many different cultures and people are there, and they all the cultures melting together. And so clearly the way that she was raised, I mean, it's not like she's putting on an act. This is Awkwafina, as you said. It's right. Awkwafina playing Awkwafina. Yeah, so I didn't have any complaint like that, and because I like Awkwafina, so I know her stuff and how she acts. But she has that strong personality, and she's got the voice that is very distinct. And again, if you like Awkwafina, then you're like, hey, cool, it's Awkwafina doing something else, and I like her. Or if you don't know her, you might be like, what is she doing? Because she does have such a unique sound, and you know. But I think she did a really good job with the movie. I do wish she could have gone a little crazier, like Robin Williams, as Tom was saying in Aladdin. But I think she handled the material she was given well. I think she does a good job with the voice acting. I also think her emotional beats, she hit those, and it sounded really good. Overall, I really liked her. It just took me a little bit to get used to, and I'm not sure why, you know, just because I like Awkwafina and I was into the movie. It just took me a while to get used to that. Maybe that voice in the dragon, the way the dragon was designed, you know, there was something there's something that didn't fit. Like when you look at someone, like a character or a drawing, and you say, okay, cast that voice. Like to me, the Awkwafina voice didn't fit in the dragon the way that I saw the dragon. But once I heard the character and got to know the character of Sisu, I think she did a really good job playing that character. Does that make sense? Like, I just...
Or once she got, like, her human form, I guess. Was that better for you?
I mean, that does help to see a human form with a voice. But what I mean is that I just, when I picture that blue, sparkly, multicolored dragon, I just don't pick Awkwafina. Again, that has obviously nothing to do with me liking Awkwafina. It doesn't fit right to me right away. But I really like the character and how the character was developed and the way that she played the character. So now it's like, if I watch it again, I think I'll like it because I already know it. But it just took me a second to get used to it. But yeah.
I think some of that is that, like, when they drew the genie, like, he kind of looks like Robin Williams. I mean, it's not like a dead ringer, but there's something about...
Sure.
His face that is reminiscent of Robin Williams without just being a flat out recreation of
his
face.
They would do that a lot. Look at how like Hades, you know, in Hercules.
Yeah.
You know, how that ends up looking like what's his face that we don't talk about these days. But
but yeah, there was a period, yeah. And I feel like that started with the genie or with the genie, like, that, like, they were like, oh well, if we're gonna get this voice that's instantly recognizable to people, let's make that character kind of look kind of like it. And I don't feel like Sisu necessarily looks like Awkwafina. And I don't know if that was just because they figured she's not as well known as Robin Williams was at that point. So they like, the average person watching this movie probably doesn't know what Awkwafina looks like, especially with the age range.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so they've just felt it wasn't as important. I don't know. But yeah. I do agree, ultimately. Like, I think it might have worked a little better if the dragon had looked a little bit more like Awkwafina.
Yeah, that might be what it is. Because, I mean, the dragon, again, the animation is gorgeous throughout this whole film. And the way that they create these dragons, they almost, and I don't mean this is a bad thing, but they're so colorful and creative with the design. It's almost like My Little Pony versions of dragons. Like, they're very bright and colorful, and I think they're definitely tapping into, like, the kids, because, you know, obviously we see a lot of dragons in film, and they can either be like Game of Thrones, big and scary and dark and detailed, or they can be, you know, bright and colorful, like Mushu's a dragon and Mulan, you know, but dragon. Here they definitely make them very sparkly and colorful, and so very appealing to kids. And but the design either way is detailed and meticulous. The hair of Sisu, you know, you can see all the little hairs, and she has like a rainbow or like a multi, almost like a cotton candy-ish, like a blue and pinkish kind of a combination to her. So the animation is stunning, and I think they did a great job. So I think you hit the nail on the head where just me trying to fit Awkwafina's voice with that design, I didn't see it right away. But the design is not the problem, and she's a great actor. So those things are, you know, separate issues. But anyway, everything looks really great with the animation of the characters, the creatures, the little pill bug. Tuk Tuk, I think, was the name of the Alan Tudyk character. So they're basically on this quest. She says, you know, I need to save my father and all these people, and we need magic. And so we find out that Sisu, her power is dun dun dun. She's talking about all these great powers, that she's like, I'm really good at swimming. I thought that was hilarious that she got the dragon that was good at swimming. And, you know, clearly we see her use her skills, but at face value, when you're on your quest, you're probably looking for a little bit different magic than the swimming abilities. So she's not able to help her right away, but as they go on their journey and get these pieces of the orb, we find out that any orb she comes in contact with, she is able to get that piece's ability. And so, again, you just kind of have to go with the kids movie and magical movie. Like, somehow the orb had all these powers, but yet the pieces were split up and each one got a power. Like, I mean, there's really no way to explain how that happened, even by their rules. But each piece of the orb, no matter the size, whatever, has a perfectly sectioned off power, if that makes sense. So they go on their journey, and she, along the way, is able to get different abilities. So the first place that they go to, were they in Spine? Does anyone remember the order of where they start off? They were like in the middle of the map. I can't remember the one where they get that first power. It's spine or
I don't remember
or tail. They're at the end of the map, and so I think it may have been tail, but they go.
I think tail's the first one.
So they work their way up from there then, and so they find the leader of tail had been hoarding the power of the orb, and so she's sitting in the middle of this room that has like spikes in this pit, and it's just this column in the middle of it, and so her and Raya and Sisu have to make their way over, and hijinks ensue, you know, and Sisu has no idea what she's doing, so she's really holding her back at first, but she uses her grappling hook sword to get over all the spikes and everything, and she cleverly does the Indiana Jones booby trap thing and takes the orb, and she we find out that Sisu gets the power of shape-shifting from one of her brothers or sisters. I didn't keep track of all the names and abilities, so you're just going to have to deal with that, right? So this dragon had shape-shifting ability, and we see Sisu take the form of a woman, and so and I could kind of see Awkwafina in the human form, I think. Maybe they animated a little more closely there. Okay, so they probably debated like what they would do with the dragon and the human, and so I think they obviously knew that that was at least important to some respect if they did it with the human character. So she turns into a human, and then as they're trying to escape, we see that Gemma Chan's character Numari, all grown up, comes and confronts her, and we learn that Raya stole the map from her, and she knew where she would find her, and you know, they end up having a little fight there, and they get away, and they escape by water from there. So this is where we run into our next character. They pick up people along the way, basically from each of the five factions, the other four factions. She picks up a different person from each one to where, if you haven't guessed it by now, as we talked about, they're all going to end up coming together in the end. So she picks up this little kid along the way, who Boone was the character, and he has, all these characters have lost the other people of their village or their family members. So she ends up, they end up boarding his boat, and he's got a little a floating restaurant basically that's docked in this area, and of course he is just wants to cook for them, and they want to escape, so they hire him. And I thought that was a really fun sequence where she ends up paying him all that jade to help her escape, and he's like, all right, let's go. And it looks like it cuts to almost like the Sam Raimi thing where like they do the close-ups, and it looks like he's gonna hightail it out of there, and then like the last one, his little rowing stick, and he just slowly pushes off the dock. And that was a really fun moment. I like the character of Boone. Like I think he was a really good comic relief, and it gets the younger, you know, a younger character that the little kids can relate to. He's supposed to be 10 in this, so like I think Raya's 16, she was 10, around 10 when the movie opened, so here we have 10-year-old Boone, and he's a total ham and most of the comic relief, and so they escape with him. The only way they're able to get away is that we find out that Sisu's power actually does have some functionality besides just, I don't know, winning gold medals at the Olympics. She's able to go under the boat and use her swimming ability to like as a propeller. She turns into a dragon. And we should mention that they're hiding Sisu, the fact that Sisu's the last dragon. Like, because of course none of these people have ever seen a dragon, and they've been gone for hundreds of years. So Raya finds it best to disguise Sisu, which at first as a dragon was that comedic moment where she puts a hat and a cape on a dragon and is like, all right, you're disguised now, which was obviously ridiculous. And then she has her be the human form for most of it. But a lot of this is hiding the dragon, where I think another moral of the story is, you know, don't hide who you are, which runs through a lot of kids' films. But if they would just talk and communicate, you know, and let people know what they're dealing with, the other characters maybe could have helped along the way. To Tom's point earlier, I mean, I could totally see how, you know, she doesn't know who to trust at this point. So she's protecting Sisu's identity for the right reasons, because if she trusts someone else with it, they could abuse it like Numari did in the beginning of the film. So I can see why Riot isn't quite there with trust yet, but I think they are trying to say that, you know, you have to talk to people and allow them to help you. That's part of what the movie's trying to, you know, trying to teach you.
Yeah, I mean, I get what they're going for. I just felt like, I don't know, I just felt like that part of the script just,
yeah, it could
feel pretty weak.
Yeah, especially because of the beginning. You're right. I mean, it's hard when the whole world turns into a post-apocalyptic nightmare because you trusted someone, and then you've got to earn that back. And while I do think all the characters she meets along the way, they have earned her trust, and it teaches her that you can trust people, but it's a huge leap. And also, you know, these characters are very young and not jaded, and you know, most of these characters, with the exception of Namari, you know, you have to think these are kids, and they're not trained as warriors and trying to take over the orb, right? So you've got Boone, and then they end up going to Talon after that, I believe, and they end up with the little girl Noi, who has all the monkeys. So of course you have to have the cute animal sidekicks. They sell Pop Funkos and plushies, I think, already of the monkeys all stacked up together. But we meet her, and so you've got this baby. I don't know if either of you questioned this. I had to kind of work my mind through it. I'm like, wait a minute. The Droon took everyone 6 years ago and we have a baby. I'm like, what? But I guess the Droon operates differently. Like it takes different areas at different times. And we find out in this, the leader of Talon, I believe, where she's from, is like, keeps the Droon in a, like, behind a big gate. I don't know how it all works exactly, but so what I'm guessing is that the little kid's parents were taken more recently, right? Like, I was just trying to figure out how 6 years after everyone was killed is there a baby? Because,
well, but I mean, well, but Raya's 16, a 16-year-old can have a baby. There's a whole TV show about it.
No. If the Droon turned everyone to stone 6 years ago,
oh, and
how
her
6 years
and the
later,
baby's parents are missing. Gotcha.
How can you? Yeah, so
I kept waiting for the baby to not really be a baby.
Oh, to pull the they do that in Zootopia, where you've got like the little fake baby, and then it's like, you know,
yeah, or like Baby Finster from
Roger Rabbit.
Rabbit. Like, I kept waiting for it to be like that.
No, this is a real baby who's like, get, like, you know, a really a baby. But anyway, maybe, I don't know if you guys agree, but I'm guessing that the Droon must have taken her parents, like, recently. Otherwise, that's a huge plot hole. Like, you can't 6 years later have a babe. Like, that doesn't, you know. But anyway, so my understanding is that her leader is this old lady, and she's a really bad guy. I think this is Dang Hu is the character played by Lucille Soon. And she basically, when they're going through the town, this town that's busy, like, they still do have a lot of people there because the way the leader has the Droon blocked off. And so she wants to go talk to the person and reason with them and try to get their piece of the orb. And then this so-called sweet little old lady comes, and when Sisu wanders off on her own, and Boone, of course, being the naive 10-year-old, is like, yeah, just go buy stuff from the shops on credit. That's how it works. Adults use credit. And so she starts taking things from each shop and then walking away with them. And they're like, you know, what, you don't have credit with us. And this little old lady comes and saves her and is like, yeah, I'll go take you to the leader. We find out that's actually her. And so she's this really bad guy that it keeps a lot of people trapped behind the gate and kind of feeds this thing, I think, to keep it at bay. And so behind the wall, you see all these people turn to stone. But Raya comes in, she rides the pill bug, and she saves the day and picks her up and gets the orb piece. So they've got that one now. So they've got three total. The next place they go to, I think, is the big guy, the Benedict, is it Benedict?
Benedict Wong.
Yeah, Benedict Wong, who you would know is Doctor Strange. Sorry, I'm mixed. There's so many Marvel things to keep track of now. I'm like, which movie and which appearance or whatever? But he was the other sorcerer who kind of trained Doctor Strange, you know, and the other protector there. So, I thought he did a really good job, too. He plays, you know, this big brutish type guy, and he when they get to Spine, and we find out that everybody in his village has been wiped out, or not wiped out, I should say. So, like, the way that they do it in this movie, again, being very kid-friendly, is the Droon just turns them to stone, right? So if you can break the spell, break the curse, you know, if you can use the dragon magic, everybody can come back to life. So it's very much so like a Thanos snap situation, or, you know, no one's actually getting killed by the evil power here. So it's, I mean, it's nice. At least they're preserved there. They just have to wait for, you know, the right the right way to get them out of that. But his whole village has been turned to stone. And you get that really emotional beat from this character, Tong, where he looks over at the baby's crib. And I'm sure, like, I mean, that hits you differently when you have a baby. Jeff, right. You have a one-year-old. I've got a 10-month-old. So, you know, I mean, you can definitely relate to that, that if your whole family was taken and you're just there by yourself, and especially you've got this baby and family taken from you, I mean, that hits hard. And so he at first tries to be an adversary, as they all are, and trap Raya and Sisu, and they eventually reason with him because Namari has tracked them down with her warriors. And so Raya reasons with her, or with him, and says, hey, you know, you're the only one that knows how to get out of here. Can you help us escape? And we work together. And so they end up picking him up along the way. And then eventually they get his orb after they get out of this. But here's where we get another epic showdown between the characters. And so now Raya has been training for 6 years out on her own. Namari, who I take it as Namari's the better fighter, right? She's being trained by Fang. She's a warrior that has the you know, her mom and the teachers and everything. So I think in martial arts she is the better fighter, but she's also clouded by her rage and her what she feels like she's being forced to do these things. You know, it's another one of those, like, you know, listen, your parents want you to do one thing and you want to go the other direction, but you feel indebted to them. And of course, family plays a huge piece in Eastern cultures, especially like we talked about with Mulan. And so Namari, you can tell, doesn't want to necessarily do these things that her mom is making her do. She's making her own decisions, but she's heavily influenced by her. So anyway, she's clouded. Her judgment is clouded, and she's angry, and she wants to do right by her mom. And so we get this showdown where Raya gets to face off once again with Namari, but we get another great action choreography scene. It's so cool to see martial arts come to life like this. Like, you see so many live action martial arts things that are impressive, but the way that they captured it, it felt real, right? Like, it didn't feel like cartoons fighting. The way that they got the
physical. Yeah, I think cartoon fighting has like this weightlessness to it, where like they're just characters floating in the air, but like this, you can like feel the blows. Yeah. and like I think the physics have come a long way in the animation and the technical aspect of it, and I think they did a really good job with that. I also think Namari is a great character. I just wish we got to spend more time with her. I think she's easily the most complex character outside of Raya in this movie, just because, you know, you mentioned her conflict with her parents and her culture and like her own independence about like what she wants to do, right? And I just wish they could have explored that more. And in another world, I could have seen this as being like a Raya Namari movie. Yeah. Like their relationship is like the through line for this whole movie. And it's a little bit of a shame they didn't go down that route. I think just having Raya like jump from like city to city to gather these pieces is a little repetitive, I think. And I think they could have done a little more to flesh out, like, she's not really a villain. She's like the antagonist, right? She's like the anti-hero in this. I agree.
She is
movie gets very video game esque and just like level after level, big right, boss, right, right, movie right. over.
Like, I think I can see the complaints and totally why Tom felt like it dragged. I love the visuals. I'm such an animation nerd and a huge Disney fan. Not that Tom isn't, but I'm more of a like, oh, I want the best TV with the 4K and the colors calibrated just right. So I get into that. And so I think there's so much to look at that while I could see how the story was a little repetitive, like point A to point B, point B to point C, there was so much, at least for me, to look at. Like, if the movie hadn't looked as good, I think we'd be like, all right, let's move along here. But there was so much to take in from a technical perspective that at least that part, I think, is there to balance it out a little bit better. And I really enjoyed looking at the water and the creatures and the landscapes. They're breathtaking, again, just absolutely gorgeous. And especially when we get to the dragons here after the last stone is put together, it's really neat to look at. So they end up making it to Fang, which is the last piece, and of course that's guarded by Namari's mom. Has the biggest piece, and it's in the staff that she carries. Well, we end up we end up having Namari seems like she's going to turn, and of course we can all see it coming from a mile away that, you know, she's going to pretend to be good, and once again, like in the beginning, she betrays Raya and the gang. She brings the piece, but then she ends up just wanting to, you know, steal all their pieces, and so she holds Sisu and Raya at crossbow. And Sisu, as you know, we've mentioned briefly earlier, Sisu's been teaching Raya along the way, like, don't try to attack them, give them a gift, offer, you know, just like her dad did in the beginning when he offered all the people a meal to come together. She's trying to teach Raya more like that, and Sisu says, trust me, I see the good in Namari. And Sisu looked in Namari's eyes and they had this connection. So Sisu could tell she's a good person and she's just conflicted. So Sisu tries to reason with Namari, and then Raya just jumps the gun and is scared that Sisu's going to get shot by this crossbow, ends up whipping the crossbow with the sword thing. But that ends up pulling the trigger, you know, causing Namari to pull the trigger, and Sisu gets shot and takes a fall into the water. And like, it's a pretty pivotal scene. Like, I mean, it wasn't like a total fake out scene. Like, Sisu at this point is pretty dead. Like, that's all that's to it. And like, things start falling apart from here because the last dragon is dead. And so with Sisu actually dying, and you see that the world is coming undone, the orb magic is starting to fade, and the powers are losing, and the Druun is able to come back in full force. And so it tears through Fang, and it starts turning everybody to stone, and our gang with the remaining pieces, they have to go around and try to save as many people as they can, leading them out with the orbs, and eventually they kind of fade out. And Raya realizes that once again they're all operating independently, and this is how everything fell apart in the first place. And so she's playing that memory in her head of when they all fought over the orb, and then the Druun came back. And so she realizes, we need to trust each other, we need to work together. So this is this big moment where she says, you know, we need to learn to trust. But I like what they did here. Well, even though I understand where you could see it not being as earned, or it's not as clear of a transition or growth from the beginning, I do like that she says, we need to trust, and I'm going to start. And instead of her being like, hey, trust me, give me all the pieces, she places the orb in Namari's hand, which Namari is the one that just held Sisu at gunpoint, killed Sisu, betrayed them, blah, 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 yada, yada. So I think that is really cool how they showed that trust, where Raya is like, I'm going to be the one that actually trusts here.
See, I kind of looked at it as like, well, at that point, you have nothing to lose. What you're doing isn't working. You might as well roll the dice.
Totally, you know? Totally. But I mean, she could have also been like, you give me them. Like, I know what we need to do. But it, just the way that she presented it, I think, worked really well. So
yeah. Yeah, it was a nice moment. Yeah, I like that.
And these characters have earned the trust, where I get the through line. You may not be able to say that about all the people in the world, and certainly most of the world's in stone at this point, but these characters have earned trust. Each one of them has had each other's back and has saved each other throughout this journey. So they end up all giving the orbs to Namari, and it puts together, and the big wave comes out, and the Druun is pushed back and all that. Really sweet moment before that where they all touch like hands and all form together, and the five of them actually all turn into a statue. So it's not like the last one survives and they all turn back. They all are statue, but the power comes back, and then the rain washes over the lands. Our five characters are all brought back to life, everyone in the villages and all that. And they eventually, and the dragons come back. And this is the big moment where we start to see all the dragons, all the colors, you know, they're floating through the sky, and they all come together and form like this vortex type tornado thing. They all start forming these things in the water, and they all hover around where Sisu died, and they bring her out of the water, and she comes back to life. You know, she gets this power back, and it's celebration, and they're all happy and together. She sees her brothers and sisters, and they eventually go back to Heart, and they see the father is there, and he gets to see Raya now grown up, but he recognizes her, and they have a touching moment, and that's the movie. I mean, the lands live in prosperity, and they help one another, and yeah, I really enjoyed it. I mean, it may not be the strongest Disney movie, but it's a breathtaking movie. I think it has some really good voice performances, and I like what they were trying to do with the lessons in it, and I thought it was really entertaining too with the martial arts stuff. I think there's enough action in this movie that when you do get it, it does kind of offset the slowness of the journey. So it was cool.
Yeah, I think the artistry of this movie really helps make up for its narrative shortcomings a lot. I think it's just so beautiful, and it's really great to see, and it's a gorgeous movie. Even if the beats don't all land, and I also had a bit of a issue with like the representation in the movie. I think a lot of the actors are East Asian when this is like a Southeast Asian type land, you know, and you know, like Southeast Asia is like 11 different countries, and to kind of like put them all together in this like fictional Kumandra is a little reductive, I think. But I mean, it's a Disney movie. What are you going to do? I think representation comes in steps, and I think this is a good step forward. But yeah, I wish they cast more Southeast Asians.
I think that's the next step for sure, because you want representation. And so instead of like a white guy playing Aladdin, you know, like you ended up with all that stuff. They used to do, which they cast for the star, right? They cast for the celebrity. And so they used to be, it didn't matter what you looked like, it's a voice, and they would cast because you're a name. Now they got a lot of big stars that are Asian, so like the representation's there. But then putting Asian under one umbrella, like I completely agree, and I thought the same thing watching the movie. I'm like, that's great that they got an all Asian cast, but Asian doesn't mean one thing, right? So totally, I think that's the next step. Like, they still cast Gemma Chan and Sandra Oh. We didn't even mention Namari's mother is Sandra Oh, and Daniel Dae Kim and Awkwafina and Kelly Marie Tran. These are the big names. Like, those are names you know, and they got them all in this, you know, Asian movie. And so I agree that I think as time goes on, they'll get more specific with those things. But
I feel like they have more latitude in that regard, since it is a fictional land.
Yeah.
You know that. And I think that's why they did this with Moana too, right? Where it's like, I think they're trying to hedge their bets by saying we're going to like incorporate things from this culture, but it's not a specific culture. So if we don't get it exactly right, you can't be mad at us.
Bingo. That's the main reason. Yeah.
But then people still get mad at them.
but that's why it's an amalgamation. Yeah. You're right. You can also, so you have representation from each of the factions, so they can say, oh yeah, I relate with that, I relate with this. But then when they get it wrong, if they were that one thing, everybody from that culture would be like, that's not how we do it, that's not how. And they can be like, no, this isn't that, this is this thing we made up. And so it works well for, you know, for the story that they've created. And I
think it helps that there's a lot of Disney, of white Disney characters that also come from fictional lands that are obviously not fictional in their reference points, like Frozen, right?
Sure.
Like that's, you know, and I'm trying to think, like Tangled is just a generic British kingdom,
might
right?
be French, yeah. I don't, yeah, but
French,
you're right.
So it is, I don't know.
Yeah, like I believe it's France, but I'm not sure. I mean, I know Beauty and the Beast is, but Tangled might be too.
Yeah, but you, I think that gives them some cover too. That it's like it's because like if they were only doing it with the non-white characters, like then it would be like, well, wait a second, we get the game you're playing here.
Mm-hmm. So yeah,
but I just wish the story had been better, because it is, like you said, it's a beautiful looking movie, and it's well acted. Like I just don't feel like the story was quite there, and I think this is where you really see the difference in writing styles with Pixar. Is like Pixar will just rework and rework and rework a screenplay.
They'll throw the whole thing away if they don't like it and start over.
I mean, they've done that two or three times where it's just like, we completely pitched it and started over because we just wasn't where we wanted
it. Toy Story movies.
Yeah, famously. I mean, they did it with Toy Story. They did it with WALL-E. They did it with...
Yeah, no, you're right. That's the thing. And I think Disney has been there on a roll. Like the stories when it comes to Wreck-It Ralph and Big Hero 6, those are fully formed. I think the lessons are there. I think they nail it. Zootopia is a masterwork with what it says about race and treating people the same, no matter how they look and all that. Like Disney has got it to where they've been Pixar, like up there with Pixar. Like I said, the lines are blurred. I agree. Where this falls short is the story, and it isn't to the level of those others. So while it's not like the best of the best of the Disney, I think they did a very good job with it. And if they could hone it in a little bit better and get back to like those previous ones we mentioned where they just nail that theme throughout.
Yeah.
You know,
it also shows you where expectations are at, because like if this was a DreamWorks movie, we'd probably just be jizzing all over it, right? Because it's like they're just not at the same level. Even when they do something right, they're just not at the same level.
Maybe How to Train Your Dragon is pretty like top tier animation in general.
I like the first one, and then the next two just were like
really. I thought that third really brings it home nicely. But anyway, but this is Raya, and I mean, would you guys? To me, I feel like with being at home still with the quarantine stuff, like this is $30 on top of Disney. I guess I kind of know how Tom feels, but to me, if you're going to bring a family of four to the theater, I mean, $30 is less than the tickets, not to mention all the concessions and stuff.
Let's talk about that for a second, because I think this box office has not been that great for this movie.
Yeah.
I think Tom and Jerry last week did better than this, and it was free, right? And I think a lot of that...
I just real quick to piggyback to the counter to that argument is I think a lot more people have Disney Plus than have HBO Max. Mm-hmm. So it's like it's not perceptually free to a lot of people because they don't have HBO.
Like they
Max
might have to sign up for HBO Max to get Tom and Jerry, and they're and like, "Well,
that's
we'll just
a barrier,
go to the, yeah,
you know." But yeah, like I agree. I think $30 on top of a monthly membership, I have a hard time swallowing.
I think so. I think they backed that $30 out of what you said, Kevin, where like, oh, you'd take your whole family to go, and like the transportation and the concessions and the stuff, it all comes out to way more than $30. But like, you're at home, right? You're stuck at home and you're paying this $30, and it just feels bad, I think. I think it feels bad to pay that $30. And I don't know if I would have if, like, because, I mean, obviously I'm a member of the press. I got to see this for free, but I don't know if I would have pulled the trigger on $30 to see this.
I hate that people feel that way, and
I'm not
saying that you should feel different, whatever. I'm just saying I hate that it feels that way because Disney is putting out new movies for people to watch,
right,
and
right.
These
oh,
movies
understand.
Cost hundreds of millions of dollars, and they have to recoup their money, and so I wish more people saw the value or that there was more value there for them, because it's like, I get both sides. I totally get that if you're going to spend $30, you want a big screen and surround sound stuff that maybe not everyone has. But on the flip side, it's like, well, Disney, if they don't make enough money to make this profitable, aren't going to be making these movies for us to watch. So like $30, I personally would pay it in a heartbeat for this if I didn't get it to review, because the value is there, to me at least, for, you know, the whole family watching it, unlimited viewings. When I buy a ticket to the movie for $7-$10 and for the whole family, I don't get to watch it more than once. So for people being like, well, you if you cancel your subscription, you can't watch it. Well, I guess what? That's one step ahead of me going to the theater, like for rewatch.
I get everything you're saying, and you're not wrong. It's just you're not right.
Yeah.
But seriously, like everything you're saying on paper makes sense.
Right.
It's just a psychological barrier. And for me, the barrier is I already pay monthly. And what I think they might benefit from is, and I get why they don't want to do this, especially at this point. Although I feel like Disney Plus has reached a tipping point in terms of number of subscribers that they don't have to focus as hard on acquiring new subscribers. Like, I mean, I know it's always going to be a metric for them. Like, I'm not dumb. Yeah,
they already hit their 3 or 4 year goal in 1 year.
Right. Yeah. So like what I think would maybe get people over the hump and it's again, totally psychological. Mm-hmm. If Disney Plus came at me and said, you know, here's Raya and the Second to Last Dragon, right? And it's, and anyone can rent it from anywhere for $30. But if you're on Disney Plus, you can rent it for $25.
Yeah. Yeah. Give them the discount.
Yeah.
Because now I feel like, okay.
Your membership paid into
my
that.
Membership,
yes.
it gets me something.
That's smart.
Like, and my membership gets me a lower price point on this movie because everything you're saying is right. This $30, since most people are getting a movie like Raya and the Last Dragon, they have kids. They're, you know, and like, so $30 compared to a theatrical outing is a bargain. That is 100% true. But there's just a pain point psychologically to, you pay us monthly, but if you want the really good stuff, it's extra. And that just feels kind of like a kick in the nuts. But I will also say credit to them for letting people know, if you want to wait, here's how long you have to wait, instead of playing coy and be like, maybe it'll be 6 months, maybe it'll be a year. Like they could, you know what I mean? Like they could do that, but instead they say, on this date, if you have Disney Plus, you can watch it.
It's like this summer. It's June or July that it's free.
Yeah, it's not too bad. And I will also say, arguing against my point, Disney Plus is inexpensive compared to these other platforms, right?
Yeah, so, Amazon Prime is like $10 a month.
Disney, yeah, but you get your stuff delivered so much faster. Like there,
no,
there's a,
well, yeah, like, but no, I had but Amazon no, but just Prime. The video part is like $10 a month. They split okay, it now.
Oh, did they? I didn't even pay attention because I just used Prime. And so, I was paying $100 a year or whatever just for Prime. So when they threw in video, I'm like, okay.
No, that's a no-brainer. See, and I'll have Amazon till the end of days. I've had it since 2007, I think, Prime. It's gone 100, 120. It keeps going up. I'll never get rid of it. So to me, Prime is free because I ship so much stuff.
Totally. Same.
But so with Disney, it's so minimal that I still think it's free. If I'm paying $3 or $4 a month, I mean, my son's watching the little kids shows. Yeah. Me and my wife are watching the movies.
I did the pre thing and then stacked Verizon on top of it. So I got it for 4 years at like, it was like $350 a month or something. So
yeah, to me, it's not a big deal. And to
so somewhere
point,
there's a Disney executive being like, shut up.
But to your point, though, Tom, you know, and I don't want to just keep hammering the same points, but like from my perspective, you are getting something with your membership. It may not be out everywhere else, and you get $5 off to get this movie, but you're basically only paying if you want to watch the theatrical run, and then what your membership entitles you to is to watch it for free in 3 months. So instead of paying $25 now or $20 later, because
I just think perceptually it would get people, a lot of people over the hump that are like, so.
But like people are looking at this of like, oh, if I want to see it, I got to pay this extra money. This is more like, no, if you want to watch it early, pay the extra money.
Right.
If you don't, it's free in 3 months. So it is psychological, and I think in a couple years, like, we won't be talking about this because it will be the way it is, or, you know,
probably
whatever we land on will be the way it is. But totally. I just wish that people would be able to get more value from it, especially single people. I totally get it. If you live by yourself, $30 for a movie, that's a tough pill to swallow. Totally. Yes, but you know, it's getting people new movies still, and instead of Disney holding it for another year, I'm just glad that we still have movies to watch.
Sure.
And so,
absolutely,
you know, if you have a family, I think for sure it's something to consider.
Totally,
it's such a weird time, guys. It's so weird.
It very much is.
Everything's in flux. We just don't know like what everyone's strategy is. It's such a weird.
They don't
time.
Know either.
Yeah, they don't know either.
Everybody's
exactly.
Everybody's trying to find the magic formula. Mm-hmm.
But hey, don't worry. The CEO of AMC made $20 billion last year, up from $10 billion in 2019.
You mean million? He didn't make billion.
No, I'm sorry. Sorry. It sounded so ridiculous. It's all made up numbers to me. But The CEO of AMC made in 2020 $20 billion, up from oh my god, I can't stop saying. He made $20 million, up from his $10 million salary in 2019. So 2020 was such a great year for theaters.
That's
gave him double.
Crazy.
That's just gross. So. Yep. Okay, well, I guess that's it for this one. Let's go around the table, and everyone can say where to find them.
This is Kevin. You can follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett.
And Jeff, where can everybody find you?
You can find me on my blog at strangeharbors.com. You can also find me on my own podcast, the Strange Harbors podcast. And you can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Strange Harbors.
And this is Tom. You can find me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at Facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. Find the show online, Facebook.com/Real Spoilers. And of course, don't forget our Patreon, Patreon.com/Real Spoilers. So that's it for this one. Thanks for tuning in. And until next time, Enan is immortal if Draco is alive. Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice because we already warned you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.